Welcome to the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. I'm your host, David Yosifan, Associate Professor of Law at Santa Clara University School of Law in sunny Santa Clara, California. This is episode 3 of the Social Responsibility Podcast. I hope you enjoyed episode 2, our interview with Stephen Bainbridge. Got a lot of nice feedback on that. Check it out if you haven't heard it yet. Have another exciting conversation lined up for you today with a thinker who perhaps stands midway between myself and Professor Bainbridge in terms of his thinking about corporate social responsibility. Subscribe to us on iTunes so you can be sure to get all of our episodes automatically updated for you. And follow us on Twitter at David Yosifan. That's David, Yosifon. I'll post it, I'll tweet it every time that we are posting a new episode for your listening pleasure and edification, for your activism, for your analysis, for your investigation of the predicament in which we find ourselves. This episode is sponsored by the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics here at Santa Clara University, and we're grateful for their sponsorship. My guest this afternoon is Professor Robert Ree of the University of Maryland, Francis King Carey School of Law. Professor Ree graduated from the University of Chicago as an undergraduate. He did his legal studies at George Washington University, where he took his JD, and then he has an MBA from the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Ree is a creative and prolific scholar who has published in numerous top law reviews. He's written articles that I think will be interesting to members of this audience across many doctrinal areas. But the article that is of interest to us in this conversation and that really drew my attention to Professor Ree's work is one that he published in 2010 in the George Mason Law Review called Fiduciary Exemption for Public Necessity, Shareholder Profit, Public Good, and the Hobson's Choice During a National Crisis. In this article, Professor Ree develops what I think is a fascinating and promising idea about fiduciary exemption in corporate governance, and I'm looking forward to our conversation with him about that idea. So thanks for joining us, Professor Ree, and I wonder if you would start off our conversation, as you do in your article, by giving the kind of background narrative of the Bank of America, Merrill Lynch merger debacle or success, I guess, depending on your perspective, that kind of leads you conceptually into your idea of fiduciary exemption.
Sure, David. So thank you very much for this opportunity to engage in this conversation. So I got interested in the subject matter because, like all of us, when the financial crisis was coming down, we were really witnessing history as it was being unfolded, transaction by transaction, stock market level by stock market level. I was paying very close attention to the Bank of America Merrill Lynch merger, I suppose because I had been an observer of Wall Street. In the 1990s, I was on Wall Street in the 1990s, working as an investment banker, and during this time, there was a lot of consolidation in the investment banking industry, and I knew for quite a long time that Bank of America, the Charlotte-based commercial bank, had for a long time desired a major presence in Wall Street investment banking. So for a period of time, they had undertaken a number of acquisitions. The most significant acquisition was a company called Montgomery Securities, and they acquired the San Francisco-based investment bank in the 1990s, I believe. But in the time of the financial crisis in 2007-2008, here was a Bank of America really ready to opportunistically acquire a very significant, what we used to call at that time, bulge bracket investment bank, which was Merrill Lynch. And so during this time, of course, Bear Stearns had already collapsed and was acquired by J.P. Morgan. Lehman Brothers would announce its bankruptcy, and Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs were also in financial distress. And here was Merrill Lynch. I think it was at that time probably perceived as a pretty good opportunity to now really get into investment banking. So the deal was struck. And of course thereafter, the crisis got worse and worse. When the announcement was made about the merger, of course, Lehman Brothers also announced that it was filing for bankruptcy, and that really triggered another phase of the financial crisis. And in the months that ensued, Bank of America learned to its dismay that Merrill Lynch was losing money in incredible sums on a daily basis, stunning sums to the tune of billions of dollars.
So this was after the merger deal had been struck, but before it had closed, before it was finalized.
Yes. There came a question whether or not that these losses were so significant that it constituted a material adverse change in the merger agreement, and whether or not, pursuant to that clause and provision in the merger agreement, that this was an opportunity to, in essence, for Bank of America to cut the cord in terms of the merger agreement and let Merrill go. And so these were the discussions that were taking place with the Bank of America CEO, and the Bank of America CEO raised this possibility with the government officials, the Federal Reserve Governor, as well as the Treasury Secretary at that time, Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson. And so there was a fascinating discussion that took place between those three individuals, and ultimately, of course, Bank of America did end up closing on the Merrill transaction. But looking at the testimonies of the principal parties involved, the congressional testimonies, you saw this really clear tension between on what the duties of the board of Bank of America should be with respect to shareholders, with respect to any obligation to the public or to the government. Clearly, the government was involved in this matter and had a very significant interest in not having another Lehman. In other words, it was pretty clear that if the cord was severed between Bank of America and Merrill Lynch, that Merrill Lynch would go under in the same way. And so could the financial markets and the broader economy in general withstand Lehman and now Merrill Lynch? And if Merrill Lynch goes under, then what's the next one to go under? And this ties into this idea of interconnectedness of the different firms. And so clearly, the government had a very significant interest in having that merger, having that marriage go through. And they put the government put extraordinary pressure on Bank of America, the CEO of Bank of America, as well as the board of Bank of America. And so this really raises the issue in the context of a crisis. What are the duties of a board in terms of coming to the rescue of the government and or the public? Now, I think this issue is raised in the context of a financial crisis among Wall Street banks, but I think we can see perhaps not so implausible context in terms of other types of crises. We can think about wars We can think about pandemics. We can think about natural catastrophes in which perhaps the corporations, large corporations with tremendous aggregation of resources and capabilities, have the capability to come to the rescue of the government or to the public. And in that situation, there might be a conflict between the economic interests of profit maximization for shareholders and the public or the government's need for some sort of an aid or assistance or rescue by a firm that has certain unique capabilities by virtue of its technology, by virtue of its resources, or by virtue of the circumstances in which the firm finds itself. And so these were the questions that I was trying to wrestle with in the paper.
So with respect to the Bank of America story, they thought they had an opportunity with Merrill Lynch. They struck the deal. As the due diligence period is going on, financial conditions change, and it starts to look like Merrill Lynch is a more flea-ridden dog than they had initially thought it was. And internally in Bank of America, they start to think, maybe we want to get out of this. Maybe it's not in the best interest of our shareholders to pursue this deal or to consummate this deal. At the same time, the government steps in and puts pressure on the Bank of America board, saying that we really want you to pursue this deal, that it's in the best interest of society generally, the financial markets generally. They worry that the government is worrying that there really will be catastrophic systemic consequences if the deal is not consummated.
Yes, I think that's right. And there are perhaps even some negotiations overtures. Perhaps the Bank of America might have used these losses as a way to renegotiate the price of the deal. One doesn't know exactly what the negotiators are thinking in this circumstance, but that's also another possibility that they still like the Merrill deal, but the price was too high. We struck it at too high of a price, particularly in light of these new circumstances, and maybe the invocation of a termination of the merger agreement would bring the parties to the settlement table to recalculate the merger consideration. That could have been perhaps another plausible situation. Of course, that doesn't help the government. The government is not, in this particular case, concerned with who got what in the merger consideration, whether the Bank of America shareholders did better than the Merrill Lynch shareholders. But the government is concerned about the merger going through and not causing any more turbulence in the financial market than there already is, and certainly a failed merger with Merrill and casting Merrill off on its own to surely its demise would have exacerbated a very bad financial market.
Mm-hmm. The part about the story that as you tell it that to me is at once humorous and maddening, infuriating, and really thought-provoking is the way the story ends is that Bank of America rethinks the matter after being pressured by the government and finally comes to the conclusion, oh, after all, it is in the best interest of our shareholders to go through with the deal. So in other words, they don't announce, we have our reservations about this deal, we actually don't think it's in the best interest of our shareholders, but we do think it may be in society's interest, so we're going to go through it anyway. They don't do that. Instead, they deliberate, and even in their board minutes and before Congress, they come forward and say, after all, we concluded this. It does turn out it's in our shareholders' best interest. But you're suspicious of the veracity of that assertion.
Looking at the record, there were probably very complicated thoughts and conversations that occurred among the principal parties. That would be the Bank of America CEO, as well as each individual board member. I do find it implausible that the board, on a pure thought, thought that that this was in the best interest of the shareholders of Bank of America, period, end of sentence, and there are no other qualifications in our thought. Mm-hmm. As can be the case in quite a number of routine actions and transactions that any corporate board would consider in the routine course of the matter. Do we make this acquisition or not? Yes, it's in the best interest of shareholders, and so forth and so forth. I think this is a particularly challenging time for a board with a set of, I think, incredibly complicated considerations that the board members were presented with, including the possibility that they would be removed under federal powers from their board position as well. I would imagine that consideration, like all board members, are in their thoughts as well. There was an interesting testimony by one board member who testified before Congress, I believe, and his testimony, it wasn't a testimony, but he was testifying about a particular email that he had written, the email says, in effect, unfortunately, it also screws the shareholders. Those are the email terms, not mine, so I want to make that clear. I think the board members did understand not attempting to renegotiate the merger consideration, or perhaps even the merger itself, or perhaps not attempting to invoke a right that could have been found in the merger agreement, was probably not in the best interest of shareholders, at least shareholders in the short term sense of that word. Mm-hmm. There was probably some consideration given to the fact that, as I alluded to in the beginning of our conversation, that Bank of America had for a very long time had major investment banking ambitions, and this goes back to Hugh McColl and Nations Bank, which was a predecessor bank before Bank of America, and so there was there were these long held unrelinquishing investment banking ambition, and so here now finally is a chance to acquire one of the five bulge bracket investment banks, and they did that, and so they do have Merrill Lynch now, but certainly at that time the multi-billion dollar losses that were being seen on a daily basis must have been stunning. Even for Wall Street, which is regularly used to dealing with billions of dollars.
So when we talk about, in this context, the pressure that the government was putting on Bank of America, they actually, under the architecture of banking regulations, the federal government actually had the authority, if they thought it was in the public interest, to remove certain directors or an entire board from a major bank like Bank of America. In that context, they had the power to do it as a matter of banking law. Is that right?
Yes.
But that wouldn't be, that wouldn't necessarily apply in other industries, although there might be, there might be the kind of pressure. But I take it from the way that you present the story and the way that you line up some of these statements from the directors, that they were willing to pursue the public interest here, whether it was from the pressure from the government or a sincere belief on their own part that this is what the economy needed, this is what the polity needed. And so they were willing, even if it wasn't narrowly in the shareholder interest, to go through with the deal. They were willing to go through with it in the public interest, but that the prevailing idiom of corporate governance law, the prevailing norms or the prevailing law, is that they had a fiduciary obligation to shareholders always, irrespective of whether there is a collateral social crisis or not. And so this is what it leads you to your innovation of the idea of a fiduciary exemption in times of crisis. So can you say a little bit more about that prescription or that innovation?
Yes. So when this type of event is occurring, when we are, I believe, dealing with these types of extraordinary losses, when there are, for example, opportunities to perhaps renegotiate something to the benefit of large amounts of money, and the opportunities are foregone, or that there is a sacrifice of profit on behalf of the government or the public, particularly in these sums of money, then there is always, I believe, the specter of litigation and shareholder litigation. And the Bank of America CEO and the board were surely aware of these possibilities and these prospects. And it put them, I believe, in a particularly dangerous or precarious situation. So the types of pressure that were coming from the government and from shareholders must have been fairly significant. So in this particular situation, there are provisions in the corporate statute that allows for the provision of aid to governmental authority, and we see this in the Delaware statute, and we also see this in the Model Business Corporation Act as well. And so in light of these corporate powers, the power of the corporation to come to the aid of governmental authority in times of crisis and necessity, yet at the same time we have the shareholder primacy norm, the observance of shareholder primacy norm, the importance of shareholder profit maximization, the norm that we find in corporation law and corporation practice, that these two notions might actually conflict. And we see that possibility in a very concrete way in the Bank of America Merrill Lynch merger situation. And so in these types of situations, I do think that there are very persuasive arguments that corporations can and should come to the rescue of the public, come to the aid of governmental authority in times of national crisis. And in this situation, profit might be sacrificed. And if profit is sacrificed, then I think we can be fairly certain that some shareholders, at least, will be quite upset about this. And so that raises the specter of litigation, of shareholder suits. And so in this situation, might it be good policy to have some sort of a protective mechanism for the board, some sort of an explicit exemption from the shareholder primacy norm, and so that we can have a bright line curtailment of lawsuits from shareholders when a corporation does expend resources, perhaps quite significant resources, to come to the aid of the public or to a government that is in crisis. And extending this thought, we can think of a number of different situations, I think, not so implausible situations as I have suggested before. For example, what if there is some sort of a pandemic in which there are some pharmaceutical companies that have the unique capabilities to be able to address this matter. And what would that entail? Perhaps that may entail the provision of certain resources to significant sacrifice of profit or opportunity, or in times of great natural catastrophes. So we can think about significant catastrophes in our recent history, for example, Hurricane Katrina, the South Asia tsunami, with weather patterns being as they are, with the unpredictability and the severity of weather due to global warming, that's something that we can see corporations might have unique capabilities in terms of logistics, transportation, the provisions that where aid to the government or aid to the public, either as a matter of charitable donation that would come under one section of corporation law, or in the context of providing government with aid or resources to handle a particular crisis. I think that's probably, in my mind, a very good thing. And again, the real problem, legally speaking, is one of the economic interest of the shareholders. And so on, if that's the balance, then in this particular set of circumstances, I think a protection for the board for doing something that is within the corporate powers as specifically set forth in the corporate statutes is a good thing.
So I take it that your view is both that this power is already present in the statutory law, especially of Delaware, but that, you know, it might be made more explicit, and irrespective of disagreements about whether that power already exists in the statute, you advocate it and believe that it is would be socially desirable. Let me ask you this. I think many listeners of this podcast might be agreeing with you, but wondering why you don't take it further. That is, why not empower the board generally to be attentive to the social consequences of corporate activity, and authorize the board generally to deliberate or constrain profit taking where the board concludes there are adverse consequences to the community generally or to different stakeholders, and the corporation is well placed to either aid those stakeholders or mitigate harm that would be done to them in the ordinary course of business. Why limit this to the kind of calamitous circumstances that you describe?
I think that the board of directors already has a significant degree of discretion in managing the business and affairs of the corporation, and as permitted by the business judgment rule, which I see as really a rule that limiting the liability of the board, which is one pillar of corporate law, and the other pillar of corporate law being the limited rule of limited liability of shareholders as well. So I see those two rules as being the two pillars of corporate law, and so I think that they already have significant discretion. Of course, a case that a lot of people point to is the Wrigley case, with whether or not is the Illinois case discussing whether or not the having night baseball is a good thing economically, and whether or not the owners of the baseball club were proper in foregoing that opportunity for night baseball in consideration of the effect of having lights at Wrigley Field, including the neighborhood. And so there, the court sided with the management on that particular case. I think that that courts use this for the best interest of the corporation and the long-term interest of the shareholder. And that last phrase, the long-term interest of the shareholder, that's a very abstract concept. And I don't think that it necessarily covers the interest, the economic interest of shareholders in this particular case. And so there's a lot of leeway and flex given to what is in the best interest of the corporation and shareholders in the long term. I think that a board has already very significant discretion and powers to make decisions in an informed, good faith basis and in the best interest of the corporation. And they can determine what actually is in the best interest of the corporation, and perhaps it is in the long term interest in the corporation to have, for example, a happy community or a happy employees or happy stakeholders, or to abide by and go beyond all regulatory precautions in a particular area. And so I think that there are tools available for board members and boards to really exercise their best judgment on a particular matter and decide matters with conscience.
Well, let me pitch my question in a thank you for that response. It's a very thoughtful one. I want to pitch the question perhaps in a slightly different way. When I look at the subprime mortgage meltdown and various accounts that are available as to what happened, one of the questions that comes to my mind, and I guess I would just ask your opinion on this, is to what extent was the shareholder primacy norms, the shareholder primacy norm responsible for the development of the conditions that led to the crisis itself? So in the ordinary course, directors, I think, take it that their responsibility is to pursue shareholder value. It might be the case, as you described, that they think that they can best pursue shareholder value by well serving the interest of other stakeholders. But where that isn't the case, they're obligated to pursue the shareholder interest, even if other stakeholders are harmed or simply not considered in that course of business. So to put the question squarely, can we say that shareholder primacy in the ordinary course is what led to the subprime meltdown, and your proposal would allow a fiduciary exemption in such circumstances? If we were to alter the shareholder primacy norm in the ordinary course, maybe we could avoid some of the catastrophes that would require the exemption to rescue.
Yeah, so thank you very much for that question. On the relationship between shareholder primacy and the financial crisis, my answer to that is there might be a connection between maximizing the share the profits of shareholders, or maximizing more likely the share price of the firms, and maximizing profit in a very short term way, without giving thought or consideration to the externalities that would be imposed on the others, and in this particular case, the externalities to the economic system itself, and to the destruction or the near destruction of the financial system, the system in which these very parties work in. And so there was certainly a lot of short-sightedness and short-termism related to their conduct. I also think that there's a large agency problem as well. That a lot of the things that were occurring inside these investment banks were not in the best interest of shareholders. Shareholders, as this abstract notion of the residual owners of residual claimants of the firm, and so I don't think that. Do think that there were also large agency problems, and that why were the bankers doing what they were? Well, if they can show the profits on the books for that particular year, then they get the bonuses. And on Wall Street, it's all about the bonuses. It's all about the bonuses come January, what you get for that particular year. And so there is a distinctly a culture of a bonus on Wall Street. And so you get your bonus in January or March, whenever, early in the year for the prior year. Bonuses are announced in probably December, and you get your bonus, and by the time you get your money, it's another 10 more months or 11 more months, what's our bonus going to look like? It's really that type of short-term thinking on Wall Street by the traders and by the investment bankers. This type of this long-term thought to what we are doing to the public, to the financial system, to our own firm. I don't think that there was this balance of consideration, and that ties into what type of compensation structures do you have on Wall Street, what type of incentives do you have on Wall Street, were the incentives really aligned in a way where employees of the firm were looking out for the best interest or the long-term interest of the firm, which would include the shareholders as well. So that's also another piece of the financial crisis as well. And I've written about some other pieces as well. For example, the actions of the credit rating agencies and their part in all of this. But I would agree that short-term interest in profit maximization by the Wall Street firms tied to perhaps short-term interest of shareholders and the short-term interest of employees of the firm as well played a significant role.
Let me ask you just a couple of mechanical questions. And obviously this is an idea that's still in progress, but I'm curious about your thinking about how to operationalize this proposal of fiduciary exemption. Two questions. Would you require the board to explicitly invoke the exemption, that to say that they are operating under the exemption? And so one of the promises of this idea is that it allows the board to deliberate honestly, openly, explicitly. In the Bank of America situation, you get the sense when you review the record that they were deliberating in the public interest, but they were forcing their own discourse into the idiom of shareholderism. And my suspicion is that that distorts the quality of the deliberation. We can get a better deliberation if we license the directors to speak truthfully about what they're doing. But would you require them to explicitly invoke it ex ante? And then ex post, what sort of a standard of review would you imagine if a shareholder challenged that there was no cause to invoke the exemption? Would you give business judgment rule protection to the decision to operate under the exemption?
Yeah. Those are Great questions, and thank you for that. I think that in light of the goal of protecting boards in these types of challenging situations, I would envision that a board would specifically invoke this type of power and give it the exemption and the safe harbor that boards would have. And in light of the fact that I connect this to a public crisis in the aid of governmental authority, as I talk about this in the paper, I think it's hard to manufacture a type of a crisis that would come under this this power. And so one can think of perhaps many different types of situations, as law professors can. When a board would invoke this type of situation, and a safeguard that there in fact really is a crisis that's occurring, it's fairly apparent. It's fairly apparent that this corporation is uniquely situated, and that the documentation of this type of transaction with the government would be fairly clear and apparent. And in that situation, shareholders are simply precluded from filing an action. I suppose they can file an action, but we would expect a procedural mechanism in which the cases are thrown out fairly quickly.
Right. It wouldn't be business judgment rule protection so much as social interest judgment rule protection, just to put a name on it. So
yes,
and I wonder, there might be, yes, to spin this out from a policy conception standpoint, the reason you want to authorize this is that you envision that there might be a sort of temporal problem or proximity problem, that there's a social need which ordinarily we might expect the government to serve, but a corporation is in that moment, because of its expertise, because of its presence in different areas of the market, or literally different, its geographic presence, is particularly well placed to rescue the social interest, you know, in ways that the government just can't move fast enough to provide. And so might we envision an even broader mechanism where, after the fact, then the firm might petition the government on behalf of its shareholders to reimburse the corporation to some extent for the losses that it suffered in service of the public interest?
Yeah, so I think in that situation, the firm or the corporation can certainly do that. There are these types of negotiations that take place between private actors and the government all the time, I believe. And so I would... You can definitely see a situation in which a firm will petition the government for some sort of a compensation or consideration after the fact. And so these are, I think these are dialogues that would occur, but I'm more concerned about the actual provision in this circumstance of the aid to the public and to the government when a firm is uniquely situated under the circumstances, and we saw it in the financial crisis, and we can possibly see it in the context of maybe a pandemic or a natural catastrophe of some scale that might even, for example, dwarf Katrina or the South Asia tsunami. And so you can think about, in those kind of contexts, what type of private capabilities might there be? Well, the UPS and Federal Express have tremendous logistical capabilities and transportation capabilities, perhaps on scale with the government or with that of the military. You can see technology. Technology that is held by various firms, either in pharmaceuticals or it would be maybe in information technology. Who knows what the future will bring in terms of a crisis? But corporations now in the 21st century are so large with such tremendous accumulation of assets and resources and power that they might be called upon to provide a public service, or they might be requested to provide a public service. And in that situation, then I think that we want to have a system in which we can give the board of directors as much of a free hand to exercise in these unique circumstances their conscience. Because at the end of the day, I also think that there is a very significant cost-benefit analysis in that the harm to the public may be many, many orders greater than the harm, the economic harm to the shareholders in this particular case. Certainly, I think in the Bank of America case, that's probably true, in that what was the harm to the shareholders of Bank of America? Many, many billions of dollars, to be sure. And compare that to what are the harms to the financial market and all the players in the financial market, and then going out one level beyond that, the harm to the greater economy and all the people who are tied to the greater economy, and that would be all 300 million Americans as well as the global population. And so we see the scale right there of the type of circumstances that we're talking about. Very unusual circumstances, but not unpredictable or unexpected.
Well, there is certainly an urgency about this project, I think. We don't know when the next social crisis or of the acute nature that you're describing is going to hit us, but we can say, unfortunately, given the human predicament, that that it will happen and will happen again soon. You've done your work. You've made your contribution with this idea, and it is circulating, I think, through the law reviews and hopefully in forums such as this. People are beginning to become apprised of it. Perhaps policymakers will take note, or even business people, to the extent that you describe the power is already present in corporate powers, will be poised or ready to take advantage of it when called upon to do so. Or I take it that you wouldn't require firms to wait on a request, a specific kind of request from the government, but would authorize the board in its own discretion to determine that it's appropriate for them to act, right?
Yes. Yes, yes. And I'll add with that as well that I'm an admirer of your work, and I think you're doing tremendous work in this area as well. And so kudos to you.
Well, that's very kind of you to say, and coming from you, Professor Rhee, that's high praise and inspiring to me. Thank you very much for being a part of this conversation. We're going to keep apprised of your work and hope to have you as a guest again in the future.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, there it is. There's our interview with Robert Rhee on his idea of fiduciary exemption in times of catastrophe or national emergency. I think it's a provocative idea. My own thinking is that it does not go far enough, but it's certainly a point of departure in terms of thinking about how we can get our corporations to behave in a more socially responsible fashion. His is an idea, I think, that could get real footing even in our contemporary political discourse. And I hope that it might get an airing before the next crisis comes along. Please subscribe to us on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter at David Yosifon. That's David, Yosifon. I'll tweet it out every time that I'm posting a new episode of the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. But if you subscribe to us on iTunes, you'll get it automatically downloaded, provided that you can figure out how your podcasting app works. Can't figure it out, just manually download it each time. Check in from time to time. We'll certainly have an episode up next week. I hope you enjoy spending some time thinking about Robert Rees' challenging ideas between now and then. All right, cue up your outgoing music. I've got lots for you in mind. I want to roll out on some Johnny Cash. I've got some Bob Dylan in mind, some Leonard Cohen that would just be perfect to end our discussion with, but I just don't understand how the intellectual property works. It's on my field, so I just got to stay far, far away from that and just work within the contours of your own mind, where I think you're free to think through the music that you desire without paying any royalties. Cue it up. Let it roll. I'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening.